Hello and welcome to the Library Cafe. I'm Thomas Hill. Today I am very pleased to be talking with Michael Pisani, historian and professor of music at Vassar College, who will be discussing his book Imagining Native America in Music, published by Yale University Press. And we'll also be hearing selections from the music that Michael is going to be talking about. Welcome, Michael.
Hello, Tom.
Your book is about the representation of Indians, Native Americans, in Western music, and Native themes, certainly in popular music and contemporary film scores, for instance, are usually signaled by certain cliches or stereotypical signifiers, the beat of the tom-tom, for instance, and some of these may have their roots in actual Native music. But in any case, I wanted to ask you about the study of cultural stereotypes in general, because often these stereotypes give offense, in part because they substitute for honest experience, simplified reductions of, well, in this case, whole peoples and cultures in all their original magnificence and complexity. But in other ways, I wonder if these stereotypes can't be used to lead us back to this complexity. And so I wonder if you have any thoughts when you're dealing with these kinds of stereotypes in music about their value.
You know, I'm sure the idea of pursuit of stereotypes is something that won't leave us. I think a lot of people like to think, oh, cliche, stereotype. As long as I can label it as a cliche, I've pushed it away from myself. But that's very, very, very often not the case because, of course, there are many cliches and stereotypes that we live by every day and don't even realize. So we may push one or two away, but there are three or four still lurking as part of our outlook. But I think the question that you raise is a really good one. And I debated at the beginning, not being from American Indian ancestry myself, I thought, do I have a right to even write about this stuff? So what I did was I limited myself to the music written by non-natives about natives. So I figured I could at least have some right to speak for them. And the other thing is that in your question, I think you said, talking about stereotyping whole peoples and cultures, the title of the book was Imagining Native America. There is history in American culture studies going back to Burkhofer, the white man's Indian, and before, of writing about the Indian in America, and how the Indian was portrayed or how Americans viewed Indians. And I decided I think it was safer to stay clear of Indians because every Indian is an individual, unique person, whereas the culture or the America that is part of Native America does reflect more tribal traditions, etc. So I put the emphasis on Native America rather than Native Americans. That was just a conscious choice from the beginning that I emerged near the beginning of this project.
Interesting. The reason I ask about these cultural traces leading us back is that we do, as Americans, it seems to me, suffer from an extreme form of cultural and historical amnesia when it comes to Native America and its place in our past and also present. Europeans, I often find, are much more curious about Native Americans and our shared history with them than we seem to be. So I wonder then, rather than do away with, say, tribal names for sports teams, etc., we ought not to think of these few remaining traces of interest in Native America left in our culture as expressive of a desire for identification rather than appropriation, and a starting point maybe for uncovering a buried past.
I think 100 years, 150 years ago, the Native people had their voice had been taken away from them. So it didn't matter what they thought. So we could go ahead and name towns after them or name cars after them or name sports teams after them. And no Indian was going to say anything because they were not free to speak up. It was not safe. I think the more Native Americans are speaking out about their culture, the more right they have to say that's ours and you shouldn't appropriate it for the use for which it was not intended. So I think they can do that, and I would hope that they do, but it's not my business to say. I mean, when I see somebody driving a Cherokee car, I think to myself, I wonder how Cherokees who had to pick up their whole country, their whole peoples, and move to another part of the continent because people didn't want them there. I wonder how Cherokees feel about that, but I'd like to hear from them.
So, your book is about music, but more importantly, it's about the way in which music contributes to social history and some of the basic cultural attitudes that define who we are and how we all relate to each other. And this kind of influence is often ascribed to literature, and I'm a literature person. I think of Shelley's line that poets are the unacknowledged legislators of the world, and sometimes it's ascribed to painting and the plastic arts, but not very often to music, I've noticed, with the exception perhaps of rock and roll. And I wonder if you have any thoughts about why music is so often overlooked as a force that not only expresses, but helps to shape social attitudes.
I was just reading a book that's about to come out this summer by Derek Scott, and he looks at in the 19th century, the four new traditions, which were pretty, let's say, subversive. There was the music hall tradition in London. There was the minstrel shows in America. There was cabaret in France and the ballroom dancing in Vienna. And the point that he begins to make, I think we need to keep that in mind whenever we look at music, is that at some point, these cultures decided that it didn't matter what the people in the conservatories and the colleges thought about music, that they were going to let music shape society, and they started to act on it, and society responded. And so we're living like that now in a world where the artists are musicians who have wide audiences, who respond to them, and who speak to modern art, who speak to the audiences. I think this was true for music of all time. I just don't think people were willing to admit that. And of course, as media allows more people to hear more of other people's music, the issue comes into play here as to what is our music, what is their music. With radio, of course, in the 20s, it was a big thing. And now, of course, there's a lot of issue as to what's American music, or what are these songs? Are these songs really Taiwanese? Are these songs really Algerian? Or what's the American influence? Or how does it go the other way? I think that's more of an issue now that we can share so much of each other's music.
So can you take us for the rest of the program perhaps on a kind of historical tour? Musically speaking, the story starts, in your book at least, in the 16th and 17th centuries in France, since the French court seemed to uniquely conceive a keen interest in American music as well as dance.
I guess my area of expertise here, or where the interest really started, was in the late 19th and early 20th century, when so many of these, what we call stereotypes, developed and became more pointed. But before then, I realized this was a longer history that I needed to explore, and I had to dig back into 17th and 18th century. I'm not an early modern specialist, but this world is, I had to piece it together from quite a lot of sources, which meant looking at manuscripts of music, which meant reconstructing some of the pageants that were done at the court of Louis XIII and XIV. Of course, there's a lot of scholars writing on this stuff, so I could dig into their stuff as well, too. Unfortunately, not much recorded, but there were already dances. You know, what looking at this early period, 16th, 17th, 18th century, allowed me to do was look at a lot of different types of locations and places where something associated with America showed up in European music. And these might be cited in one source, but they would not necessarily make reference to the other source. So you'll read about somebody writing, say, about American Indians that have been brought over from Brazil that were on display, say, in downtown Amsterdam. They were in the late 16th century, and would write about a war dance. And then the next thing you find is in some court, Louis XIII's court, they're doing a pageant where they're representing all the continents of the world and they're representing the Americas. And you see the dancers with the feathers and you think, well, what did they dance to? These were French people dancing. How much do they know about Americans at that time dancing? Well, that's what I tried to piece together. So I'm not going to try to distill two chapters of the book, but that's what I tried to make sense out of, was how much would they have known about American Indian cultures. And there was a lot written, but of course, in those days, books were specialized and not everybody could run down to their bookstore and pick up a copy of one of the Jesuit volumes of, you know, their travels in North America. So it wasn't always so easy. So in the earlier periods, there's not a lot of stuff recorded. For example, there's a famous collection of dance pieces from the early 16th century called the Terpsichore Collection by Michael Pretorius. Tons of dances, Branly's and things like that. But one of them is the Dance of the Amazons. And there, of course, you could think that they might be referring to the old mythological Amazons, but they weren't. They were talking about the Portuguese Amazons dancing in Brazil. So that piece, there's just one piece there by him, but there are many occasions like that. Probably the most famous here, though, is the one that Rameau, the French composer, experienced. He had gone to a theater where there were two dancers. I don't know if it was father's son, older brother, younger brother, I don't remember. But they were Natchez Indians, and they were dancing. One had played a little small drum, and the other was doing a kind of a mime. And the mime was crystal clear. Rameau knew exactly what was going on in terms of the little pageant and the music. And he went home and he wrote a harpsichord piece, The Dance of the Savages, Danse du Sauvage. So that's what he incorporated into his opera, about one act of which is set in the Louisiana.
And what year is this?
1725.
Quite early.
Yeah. So this is the Dance of the Savages, the orchestral version, not the harpsichord solo, but the orchestra version he did a couple years later.
seems that from a remarkably early period, musical transculturation seems to be taking place in that native peoples are borrowing and incorporating European-style music into their own performance traditions, as well as vice versa.
That's a fascinating subject. We tend to think of cultures as being pure. This is something that James Clifford, the anthropologist, wrote about, that cultures are always changing. They're always modifying. So you would need to talk about what the Greeks or what the Italians or what the Armenians were at any particular point in their history, you know, if you want to be really true to the nature of developing cultures. You know, here's an example, is that we think of today, you know, so many tribal groups try to identify themselves as Onondaga or Oneida or Zuni versus Apache, whatever. But the thing is, these cultures were changing a lot. You know, back, we don't have recordings, obviously, and nothing much written, but there is some written music from the early period. But most of the records are in the diaries that were in books that were written by the Jesuit missionary. So they came into a lot of encounter with Americans, Indians, and they wrote about their experiences of some of the music that they heard. But one of them, Claude Dablon, a Jesuit missionary traveling from Upper Canada region and then down into parts of now the United States. You know, by the time he was notating, writing some of his experiences in 1636, there had been other missionaries at work here teaching some of the hymns from European music to some of the American tribes he worked with. So when he tried to notate one of the songs that the Indian group that he had encountered were singing, he wasn't 100% sure that what he was getting was a something that had come from that tradition as much as something that they were now partly influenced by the European tradition. So from the moment that there is contact between Europe and the Americas, it changes. The culture changes, right? It's a relativistic thing. And you can't measure it really as any kind of original, this is what original Huron music sounded like, or this is what original Onondaga music sounded like.
Can you talk about the concept of the noble savage, the aristocratic noble savage that John Dryden, I think, actually coins the term, doesn't he? And how it works into the way Native America is conceived in musical terms?
Well, the word noble savage is two-pronged, right? Because the associations, the French associations with sauvage just meant primitive. Mm-hmm. Whereas the other associations, the German associations, wilden was their word for sauvage, really did mean, you know, animalistic.
Yeah.
Primitive in that sense. Not primitive naive, just primitive wild. So the French tended to think of the American Indians as more untutored, uncultured, naive, childlike. And those that rose within their cultures to chieftains or priestesses or princesses, they were always trying to find ways to make analogies between American aristocrats and the European aristocrats. And this is something really it would take forever to go into, but just to talk about how a lot of the writers of Europe saw the Americans as justifying their own aristocratic positions, because those hierarchies existed in native cultures, for example, in primitive cultures. But anyway, noble savage is a complicated term, and it's been so much written about it already that I almost feel like we should not dwell on it, except to say that it now has that quality that the cultures will look for naive qualities in music and replicate those, so that noble savagery might sound pure, but it sounds pure and noble because it is not sophisticated. Which, of course, is generally simplifying the subject, because many of the traditions that they encountered, they didn't understand very well, so they interpreted them as simplistic.
You write that the French in particular in this period approach native cultures with a kind of wonder, and then this moves into a period of what one would have to call diplomacy, where there are groups of natives coming to the court of France. And does the noble savage, I wonder then, in that it essentially defines, would define these representatives as aristocrats, fellow aristocrats, make this kind of political activity more legitimate?
Oh, sure. I think you're right about that. The idea of a wonder, amazement, awe, this comes from Stephen Greenblatt. He wrote about this in early modern depictions of Americas. But there was a change that started to take place in the 18th century, and it started with the French too, but the English were bringing delegations of Native American aristocrats to Europe. And sometimes these were frankly political. And I mean, England was trying to get as much territory away from the French, and the French were trying to get, and so they were trying to work with the Indian tribes. And so they would bring these tribes over as delegates and then as representatives to go back to their people and say, you know, the English are really good. They're treating us well. We should work with them, etc. But when the Cherokees or the Creeks were in England, they were treated like royalty. They were brought to the theater. They were given sumptuous meals. And you know, when they prayed or when they sang, when Ostenaco arrived in England and he raised his arms and sang, you know, welcome to the shores, Timberlake right away wrote this thing down, wrote this experience of how he greeted the old world.
So how is this diplomatic view of Native America expressed musically?
Ah, that's a good question. Well, the music for the French portrayals of American Indians that I found in the 17th century is based on dances, Branleys and things like that. That's not true of the 18th century. It's more based on the march, on the English march. The French march tended to be in three, but the English march was always in four and always had the, you know, tum, bum, ba, bum, 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 ba, bum. So you find these Indian marches written throughout the 18th century that if I played them for you now, you wouldn't think anything was remotely American about it or Native American about it. But there they were. There are Indian images at the masthead of the music, or it's being used in a play, or it's being used in a pantomime, or it's being used, for example, here's a play at the end of the 18th century, a production of Robinson Crusoe. You get the Indian music. When they pull up a boat onto the shore, the orchestra starts to play this march. It almost as if the heroic aspect of it, the noble aspect of it, was embodied in this more martial music, which leads us to something like the Death Song of the Cherokee Indian, which is really a march.
Oh, interesting. So do we have an example?
Sure. Yeah. Well, the most famous one that was circulated, popular in the late 18th century, published, and then even throughout the whole 19th century, school children sang this song. Throughout the 19th century, the Death Song, it was considered a kind of a character building song.
So there is some identification, desire for identification going on here.
Oh, I think so. Sure.
Begin ye tormentors, your threats are in vain, for the son of Alpnomuk shall ever complain. Remember the arrows he shot from his bow, remember your cheeks by his hatchet laid low. Why so slow do you wait till I shrink from the pain? No, the son of Alpnomuk will never complain. Remember the wood where in ambush we lay, and the scalps which we bore from your nation away. Now the flame rises fast, you exult in my pain, but the son of Alpnomuk can never complain.
So is there much about this that strikes you as typically Native American in terms of conventions?
Conventions, yeah. Well, no, not really, but the words were brought back from somebody who had lived for years among the Cherokee in 1860s, 1850s. And, you know, there were wars going on. The Cherokee people were involved in wars at this time. And the death song, it was an old tradition in many tribal cultures in the Americas. So the nature of the song now, the music by Anne Home Hunter in England is pretty much original. Although I do hear little components. Da 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 dum bum ba dum bum ba bum. It's sort of slightly, it has the march, that da 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 da. Plus, the number of pitches used in the melodies are fewer. So I see that as a little more primitive or simple, maybe.
We should mention in passing here Richard Sheridan's play Pizarro, which was extremely popular, and the music that was written for it, and also The Indian Princess. Why do you think there's a shift of focus to an interest of an earlier period of contact in these works between European and Native American peoples at this time?
Well, you know, I tell you, I didn't see this in the 1690s, but I saw it in the 1790s in England and then in America too, a great interest in the story about initial contact and the meetings between Europeans and Native Americans. And I saw it again in the 1890s. And in the 1990s, there were a large number of films that came out, 1492, Year of Contact, Discovery, whatever it was, many films about Indian in the Cupboard, but just a number of films that came out, Black Robe, about the colonial period of discovery. And I predict that in 2090, this will happen again. I just think it is a fascination when we come around that 400, 500, 600 year mark of America's discovery, that there is an explosion of interest in that time. So I think it was starting to kick in 1790, especially with the founding of the new nation, in finding its roots as a country, what qualities made it distinctively American.
And we should mention that The Indian Princess is about the story of Pocahontas.
Yeah, it was a well-written play by Barker. However, it wasn't even often performed in its own day, unlike Pizarro, which was a largely fictional story about the conquest of Peru, about a love triangle that was extremely popular. It was performed almost probably every year in every major city in the East and in England and certainly in Europe as well. For probably 60 years into the 19th century. It was about a rescue, and it was about a love for a Spaniard and an Indian woman, a Peruvian princess. And this always held a tremendous amount of fascination, because it's not going to be till much later that the real issues of, you know, you can talk about bringing one race of people over and meeting another race of people, but that the real practicality of it is always getting into the issue. What does this mean in terms of relationships, marriages? And I think it's already here, it's celebrated because they're both royalty, sort of in the same mold of the noble savage. It's not going to be celebrated in the 20th century. It's going to be sort of denigrated. And
so you mentioned this is a period just after the birth of the United States as a nation, and it's a time of nation building. It's also a period that follows the Louisiana Purchase of 1803 and the exploration that follows this. And reading between the lines in your book, it seemed to me that if any period in the history of the United States held the conditions for a potential for some kind of true accommodation between European and Native Americans toward the development of a shared national identity, this was it. It is the Romantic Age. It's the age of James Fenimore Cooper. It's the age of Henry Rouse Schoolcraft, who was one of the first, we could call him an ethnologist of Indian culture. Indians dominate American theater. And I wonder, do you think this was a real possibility at the time? Maybe I'm being naive here, since certainly this period didn't last, but...
Well, let's put it this way. The Europeans certainly needed American Indians if they wanted to find their way around the continent. If they didn't want to fall into a gorge or get pushed down the river or whatever, or get carried away by a cyclone, they needed to know something about the patterns of weather, and they needed to know the mountain passes and stuff. So, I mean, I'm not saying that every American had the sort of frontier mentality. It's like, you know, use the Indian to get what you want. But there was certainly some of that. Not all Americans were settlers. And they brought their musical instruments with them. That's a part that you don't often see in the Hollywood movies, is how the settlers, first they bring their guitars and their other instruments with them, accordions even, and then later on they bring their pianos, and then there was all these songs that they like to sing. And we'll be hearing a little more about that, the Little House on the Prairie with Laurel Ingalls Wilder and their songbooks, and the family had quite a few songs. Some of them were parlor Indian songs, Indian parlor songs, as they were called.
Interesting. So do we have any songs from this period, the first couple decades, any music from the first couple decades of the 19th century?
Well, that's the time that there was a lot of sheet music publishing industries starting in America. So they're published music, but nobody wants to record this stuff, unfortunately. We really do. But from about 1850, 60 or so, we have the Song of the Red Man from Henry Clay Work, which is in that same tradition, using the same kind of musical style. Yeah. We can hear some of that.
Okay, yeah, it'd be interesting.
When the pale faces came in their white wing canoes long ago from the sun rising sea, when they asked for a lodge and we did not refuse, happy then was the red man and free. He could then choose a spot for his wigwam to stand where the forest was crowded with game, for the blue and the ever-smiling land were his own till the pale faces came. For the broad grassy plains and the forest deep and grand were his own till the pale faces came.
They came like the fierce prairie. the shore, gazing now on its waves, but a handful of praise, we shall join in the chase nevermore. Till we camp on the plains where the great spirit reigns, we shall join in the chase nevermore.
When the oaks, pines, and cedars were fell to the ground, 'twas a sight that with sorrow we saw. For the game fled affrighted, and no food was found for the old chief, the papoose, and squaw. Driven westward we came, but the pale face was here, with his sharp axe and death-flashing gun. And his great iron horse now is rumbling in the rear. Oh, my brave men, your journey is done. Like the beaver and elk, like the buffalo and deer, oh, my brave men, your journey is done.
They came, like the fierce prairie flame, sweeping on to the sun setting shore. Gazing now on its waves, but a handful of praise, we shall join in the chase nevermore. Till we camp on the plains where the great spirit reigns, we shall join in the chase nevermore.
So that was Henry Clay Work's Song of the Red Man from 1868. Now, this is, you know, after the Civil War, but the style of the music and the way the words are set and the words themselves really do reflect the pre-Civil War parlor song. And these songs are written from the point of view of an American Indian. For example, the words go, when the pale faces came in their white winged canoes long ago from the sun rising sea, when they asked for a lodge, we did not refuse, happy then was the red man and free. So the idea here, of course, is that these are the white Americans, European Americans, singing these songs. Some of them family occasions around the keyboard at home in which they identify with the wronged Indian. Again, if you want to think of the very first song that we played at the beginning of this broadcast from Annie Get Your Gun, there's not a whole lot of comparison. But this song is more in the simple, straightforward musical dialect of early America, the same kind of dialect that Stephen Foster would have written his songs, the same kind of dialect that was comfortable for people sitting around the family piano playing. There was nothing threatening about the music. The words, however, are always very sympathetic. They always take the point of view of this wronged Indian characters. You know, she's lost her home, she's wandering.
An interesting figure in literature with respect to this question of identification or appropriation, however you want to look at it, is James Fenimore Cooper, and especially his great character Hawkeye, who, when he's among his fellow settlers, is a bumbling idiot, but when he puts on his buckskins and goes off into the wilderness with his Indian friend Chingachgook, he becomes himself like an Indian, a kind of noble savage.
The real American.
Unfortunately, any hope for any positive accommodation with the Indians starts to really fall apart in the 1830s, especially beginning in 1832 with the Black Hawk War, which seems to signal a kind of tipping point.
The 1830s, 40s, and 50s were a specifically hard time for American Indians because it's starting from 1820s with smallpox. There was another smallpox outbreak. I just think that the population of American Indians dropped dramatically from about 1810, 20 or so to 1850, 60. And some of it was due to disease, but a large part of it was due to dislocation of peoples and war, wars between Americans and Indians. They used to call them the Indian Wars, but that's basically because there were wars between settlers and people who were being moved out of their land, or they sensed the loss of whatever sustaining crops or animals that they needed to survive, buffalo, for example. So anyway, yeah, once you get to the tribes that are closer to the Mississippi and pushing west across the Mississippi, that's the real big issue there. I think that's where things get particularly bloody. And you have the frontier wars, you have men going off, cavalrymen fighting wars, and at home you have all their wives and children singing about, isn't it terrible what's happening to Indians? And it's this sort of two-pronged thing where that's the one way that guilt is processed.
And it was also a time when Indians were demonized for resisting conquest. And you see this in cultural products like Luisa Bendina's very popular Nick of the Woods, which featured an Indian who was really the worst of the worst. And these wars also provided an opportunity for American military men to make reputations.
Certainly the capture of anyone like Black Hawk would be considered a great coup, feathering the cap of a general, whoever happened to do it. I don't remember who captured Black Hawk. I don't know if it was someone like Tyler or somebody. But in any case, bringing him back in a parade and parading him is pretty degrading for him. And then they would ride a march, you know, to accompany him, the Black Hawk Quick Step, you know. It seems kind of ironic that you would write a march in celebration of somebody who you is basically in captivity.
Mm-hmm. Yes, you write in the book that, where is it here? One cannot hear these brisk, inspirational marches, anchored as they are by their titles, without hearing in them an attempt to bury the trope of the noble savage. And you mention also in the book that at this time Indians are not only not any more synonymous with Americans as they had been in the 17th and even into the 18th century, but they aren't considered to be Americans at all. Moreover, they're not only being physically displaced, but they're being displaced in the ideas and ambitions of white Americans. But while we're on the subject of Black Hawk, interestingly, in a kind of epiphanal moment in the life of Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, in his youth, Longfellow actually saw Black Hawk in Boston, on the Boston Commons, who was on a tour to elicit support for his people, presumably, and their ill treatment. This then develops later in Longfellow's life in his interest in Native Americans and in the great work Hiawatha, which is one of those works I think we can't overlook, if only because it was such a long-lived piece of American culture. Children, even of my parents' generation, were still being taught to recite it in grammar school. So can you talk about Hiawatha and its historical context in the 1850s?
Sure. It's interesting the way you use Black Hawk to get into. Maybe you picked that up in my book when I had happened to notice that Longfellow, when he was in his early 20s or whatever, he saw Black Hawk. Because at some point, there were certain Indians that were, Black Hawk was one of them, they were allowed the right to speak in public. So there would always be a crowd around him if he gave a talk. And he happened to give a talk in Boston Commons, which is where Longfellow went to hear him. But in any case, just seeing him stimulated this idea that the history of America was particularly linked, like with Washington Irving and others thought this, linked indelibly with American Indians. So when he sat down to write the great American epic, well, one of them in his long series, you know, he did Evangeline first, and then he wrote the Song of Hiawatha in 1859, ironically, just at the point when those Indian wars and Americans turning against Indians and not trusting them anymore was exactly happening. So he set this back in some sort of prehistoric time before the white men came. I think probably more than any other fictional Indian character, Hiawatha's probably been the one that probably most Indians don't like very much. Sort of, you know, but he's like a, I think I mentioned at some point, he's like a Superman figure. Mm-hmm. He comes, like Prometheus, he comes down out of the clouds or out of the mountaintop, you know, sort of half god, and he teaches all these Indians how to do things, how to build canoes, how to raise corn, how to do all that stuff. I guess to his credit, to Longfellow's credit, it wasn't a white man coming in and showing the Indians how to do those things. So at least it was another Ojibwe Indian.
And certainly the Song of Hiawatha has inspired many interesting musical treatments, including a treatment by Samuel Coleridge Taylor that's very famous, and also part of the work we're about to hear by Dvorak, composed at the end of the 19th century.
Yeah, 1893. Before we put this on, I just want to say there were lots of settings of Hiawatha, almost from the very year that the poem, well, the poem appeared 1855, I'm sorry, and the first musical setting showed up in 1857 or 8. Mm-hmm. So right away people are setting songs from it, because it's very musical, it's the Song of Hiawatha. So it already is speaking, in some way, begging for music. Mm-hmm. And there were cantatas, and there were lots of pieces, but the most famous, of course, the two most famous, I would say, is the incorporation of bits and pieces from his Hiawatha cantata into his symphony from the New World, Dvorak. And the other one is that big oratorio by Samuel Coleridge Taylor.
So let's play this passage from Dvorak's Ninth or New World Symphony. Thank you.
okay, what we just heard, it sounds so much like Dvorak that people don't realize it took, you know, scholar Michael Beckerman came along and he looked at Dvorak's sketches, and he looked at Dvorak's sketches that he was working on a Hiawatha, planned opera that was then a planned oratorio, a number of different things. And this was supposed to be the music for Paupakewis's dance at Hiawatha and Minnehaha's wedding. Paupakewis is a trickster type, probably like a fancy dancer, would have been dressed in a lot of paint and feathers and bright colors. Anyway, leaping over the fire and the pulling up the leaves and eddies around him, the visual imagery is very much embodied in the music, as well as the bum, 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 bum. But here it's in the chords, not in any sort of tom-tom. And then later on, when it softens up, it goes into a simpler tune. That was originally On Away, Awake, Beloved. That is the song that Chibiabo sings after Paupakewis' dance. Chibiabo gets up and sings a song. And that song, On Away, Awake, was set, and you see Dvorak's words, On Away, Awake, Beloved, over those notes. But then they made it into the symphony, and then, of course, the Hiawatha connection disappeared after that.
Interesting, because I never thought of the work as program music.
You can't say it's program music because there are so many influences in that work that no one program holds together. That's the problem, is that there's a little bit of Hiawatha, there's a little bit of the going home feeling of the Black Slaves music. And so, but I think that's what he was trying to do. He was trying to show that American music really could have these various influences, which would make it uniquely American.
Can you talk about the rise of ethnographic interest in Indian culture at this time, including interest in Indian music?
That's a very important thing because there are a lot of criticism about these ethnographers going out and doing their doctoral work or doing their, you know, being their scientific approach from the Peabody Institute at Harvard University, going to live among the Omaha and writing down their cultures and noting what they had for breakfast and seeing how they lived their lives. And I mean, it's all being told from an outsider's perspective. So this is problematic. But Alice Fletcher, working among the Omaha, worked with an Omaha singer herself who helped her notate a lot of songs. And Francis was working with Francis LaFleche, the Omaha, who helped her, well, actually he helped her provide the informants who would sing for her and then notate this music. But other people were doing this at the same time. Franz Boas went out to British Columbia, Vancouver, and wrote music of the Kwakwaka'wakw. There was the Cushing expedition that went to Zuni and the Southwest, and he traveled with people who wrote down notations. And of course, with the development of the cylinder recording in the 1880s and 90s, people could actually bring cylinders out, record the music, send the cylinders back home. This is what Edward Curtis did. He made the recordings in the Southwest. He sent the cylinders back home, and then Henry Gilbert was sitting there in Boston transcribing them all. And the fact is that people could now look at this music and they could see something written down. It gave them a means for creating sort of taxonomies of Indian music. I mean, it's probably can be seen as very threatening from a native perspective because someone else is making decisions about what's important in your music and you're not. So I think that's a key issue here. But having all these tunes written down allows composers a chance to say, oh, well, Mr. Dvorak said I'm supposed to incorporate African-American or Native American music. Well, here's Native American music as written down by Henry Gilbert, so I'll just use it in my piano piece or my violin piece or my choral piece or string quartet or whatever, and therefore my music is now American.
So let's hear these three short examples we have that incorporate this material.
Yeah. Thank you.
These are based on ethnographic recordings?
Oh, yeah, well, either the recording or the written tune,
yeah,
but
okay,
they
yeah,
all
yeah.
come from an actual Indian melody. First one was McDowell, Indian Idol. Mm-hmm. McDowell wrote this in 1902, and the middle theme, there's the first part and the last part isn't really, it's just his own fantasy, sort of imaginary. It's a nature piece, but in the middle there is the little story of a young woman who's working, who hears her lover in the distance singing to her, and that's a tune that comes from a Dakota Night Song, which he got from Theodore Baker's collection from 1882, so it comes from an earlier melody. The second one, The Chattering Squaw, I don't remember what the source of this is, but Harvey Worthington Loomis wrote two books of Indian settings, of character pieces for piano, A Prayer to Wakanda, Scalp Dance, Chattering Squaw, many things. And they're all different portraits of Indian life as he saw them. So Chattering Squaw is one where we actually hear those parallel motions. You hear dum ba dum ba da da, and the melody's moving along with it, and it's also got the throbbing tom-tom. This is 1904. Then the last one is Arthur Farwell. He's the one who published a lot of this music. And this is from his collection of American Indian melodies called Approach of the Thunder God. And what I liked about this one, I thought it would be appropriate for this radio show, mm-hmm. is that it's very serious, earnest, stoic type of music. Mm-hmm. At the same time, the rhythm, ba-ba-ba-ba-bum, ba-ba-ba-ba-bum, bum-bum-ba, is very rigid and unyielding. And I think there are, what are the words you used before, conventions that are in this music, which we start to see emerging more purely, more clearly now.
The early 20th century is a time when the United States is just beginning to become a player on the world stage. And can you talk about the development of a national music at this time and the place that Indian music had in this development?
Of course, the real American national identity in classical music came about in the 1930s during the Depression. And the rise of American folk music, you know, with the folk singers and the Woody Guthries
WPA.
And all that stuff. The work progress, yeah, all of the progresses that were supporting the recording of folk music and the classical composers who started using that, like Aaron Copland, of course, who probably is the leader of all of these. But before that generation, there were composers, like you say, who were the forerunners of that, and they were using African-American and Native American sources. One of them was Charles Tomlinson Griffiths, and Griffiths died quite young. I don't remember, it was like 30 or something. And he didn't live to achieve everything he wanted to, but in two pieces for string quartet, he did use Indian themes. Mm-hmm. And one of them is very moving, very, very emotional, very... It's like the lost authenticity of American Indians in American culture. And then the other one is more of a dance, a celebratory dance type.
Thank you.
Griffiths used these themes in a developmental sense. You know, he takes them, contrasts them, mixes them around, moves them around different keys. He's thinking like a symphonic classical composer. There's no question about that. And it's always the ethical question is when you start taking any folk music and you bring it into classical music and you start messing around with it that way, trying to bring it to some sort of high culture definition, that it doesn't quite sit well. To me, these two pieces are very beautiful. Mm-hmm. I think they treat the material very respectfully. They couch them in ways that create a beautiful landscape, musical landscape, yeah, that I always find interesting.
So in contemporary culture, I would say most of our attitudes concerning Native America have been shaped by Hollywood, and the movies that construct and express these attitudes best, the Westerns, rely heavily on music, at least as much as any other film genre I can think of. So can you talk to us about movies and movie music, and perhaps tie the traditions embedded there to these earlier traditions of composition and performance?
Sure. The composers for a lot of the Hollywood films and the sound films in the 30s, 40s, and 50s were all classically trained. Mm. Not all of them grew up in America, but they certainly knew these traditions, and many of them were. And in fact, in Hollywood, you may have one European-born composer like Max Steiner, but then you'll have a whole bunch working with him, Paul Sawtelle or Hugo Friedhofer, who were born and raised in America. And a lot of them were growing up at the time that Farwell and Griffiths were writing these pieces. Mm-hmm. So they had become a kind of part of the musical language. If you needed to write music about American Indians, this is the kind of stuff you would do. So you'll find that, for instance, in Hugo Friedhofer's score to Broken Arrow, a 1950 film that features Jimmy Stewart as the, he's like the head of the postal agency. And he's trying to get the mail from one part of, you know, Arizona or Mexico across Apache territory. And the Apaches don't let the mailmen through. So he has to go to Cochise, sit down, strike a deal with him. Mm-hmm. And so that's what he does. And so as he goes into this territory, which is sacred and private and secret ground, they let him in. And so this journey is accompanied by all this amazing music that Hugo Friedhofer wrote. But you can hear Griffiths, you can hear Farwell, you can even hear Dvorak in the background here of this music.
So can we hear some of Broken Arrow?
Sure.
On the afternoon of the third day, I was nearing the entrance to the stronghold. Juan had told me what to look for. I knew then that Cochise had given me permission to enter. I kept my hands visible, away from my weapons, and I tried to look at ease.
Quite nice. It almost works as a radio play.
Absolutely.
And parts of it do remind you of the Griffiths piece, the sad piece.
Yeah, sure, absolutely. You can hear I hear that, some of that lament.
So perhaps we could hear one more movie piece, since so many attitudes about Native Americans are permeated with this music.
Yeah, and in terms of permeate, we started with I'm an Indian Too, right? Mm-hmm. When that show, Annie Get Your Gun, was produced on Broadway 6, 7, 8 years ago, they left that out. They left that song and that whole reservation dance number out. And in fact, when Tams Whitrock now circulates that music for high school productions, it's left out too, which is, it's considered now offensive. So we go in cycles. So this next film example, Walk the Proud Land, is from a 1956 film. The music is by Hans Salter. But the film is about John Clum. He's a white scout that goes off to Apaches, and the film makes it look like he does wonderful things for them, but the actual John Klum would bring Apaches back to act in Wild West shows and things like that. But in any case, when this music starts, we see the West in color, Technicolor, 1956. The first thing you hear, we just see land, but the first thing you hear is all of this convention that you're talking about of Indian music, and then the convention is overtaken by Western settler music, which then is associated with the cowboy and the settlers. And it's interesting, nothing changes, no people are presented, but it's just the philosophy of the land, who owns it, and what it represents.
So I want to thank you, Michael, for visiting with us on the Library Cafe today to talk about your book, Imagining Native America in Music, published by Yale University Press.
You're welcome, Tom. It was a pleasure.
Thank you again for being here. It was great fun.